Unquote. Anyone who still tried to get through would be shot. Dead? Someone asked. You bet, several others answered. There was a small contingent of about 20 which maintained that those already sick should be put out of town at once. They were overwhelmingly voted down because by the evening of the 24th, when the meeting was held, almost everyone in town who was not sick had close relatives or friends who were. Many of them believed the newscasts, which said that a vaccine would be available soon. How, they argued, would they ever be able to look each other in the face again if it all turned out to be just a scary close call, and they had overreacted to it by putting their own out like pariah dogs? It was suggested that all the sick summer people be put out then. The summer people, a large contingent of them, pointed out grimly that they had supported the town's schools, roads, indigent, and public beaches for years with the taxes they paid on their cottages. Businesses that couldn't break even from mid-September to mid-June stayed afloat because of their summer dollars. If they were to be treated in such a cavalier fashion, the people of Ogunquit could be sure that they would never come back. They could go back to lobstering and clamming and grubbing quahogs out of the dirt for a living. The motion to escort sick summer people out of town was defeated by a comfortable margin. By midnight, the barriers were set up, and by dawn the next morning, the morning of the 25th, several people had been shot at the barriers, most just wounded, but three or four killed. Almost all of them were people coming north, streaming out of Boston, stricken with fear, panic-stupid. Some of them went back to York to get on the turnpike willingly enough, but others were too crazy to understand and tried to either ram the barriers or swing around them on the soft shoulders of the road. They were dealt with. But by that evening, most of the men manning the barricades were sick themselves, glowing bright with fever, constantly popping their shotguns between their feet so they could blow their noses. Some, like Freddie Delancey and Curtis Beauchamp, simply fell down unconscious and were later driven back to the jackleg infirmary that had been set up over the town hall, and there they died. By yesterday morning, Franny's father, who had opposed the whole idea of the barricades, had taken to his bed, and Franny was staying in to nurse him. He wouldn't allow her to take him to the infirmary. If he was going to die, he told Franny, he wanted to do it here at home, decently, in private. By afternoon, the flow of traffic had mostly dried up. Gus Dinsmore, the public beach parking lot attendant, said he guessed that so many cars must be just stopped dead along the road that even those manned, or womaned, by able drivers would be unable to move. It was just as well, because by the afternoon of the 25th, there had been less than 36 men capable of standing watch. Gus, who felt perfectly fine until yesterday, had come down with a runny nose himself. In fact, the only person in town besides herself who seemed all right was Amy Lauder's 16-year-old brother, Harold. Amy herself had died just before that first town meeting. Her wedding dress still hung in the closet, unworn. Fran hadn't been out today, hadn't seen anyone since Gus had come by yesterday afternoon to check on her. She had heard engines a few times this morning, and once the close-together double explosions of a shotgun, but that was all. The steady, unbroken silence added to her sense of unreality. And now there were these questions to consider. Flies, eyes, pies. Franny found herself listening to the refrigerator. It had an automatic ice maker attachment, and every 20 seconds or so there would be a cold thump somewhere inside as it made another cube. She sat there for almost an hour, her plate before her, the dull, half-questioning expression on her face. Little by little another thought began to surface in her mind, two thoughts, actually, that seemed at once connected and totally unrelated. Were they maybe interlocking parts of a bigger thought? Keeping an ear open for the sound of dropping ice cubes inside the refrigerator's ice-making gadget, she examined them. The first thought was that her father was dead. He had died at home, and he might have liked that. The second thought had to do with the day. It was a beautiful summer's day, flawless, the kind that the tourists came to the main seacoast for. You don't come to swim because the water's never really warm enough for that. You come to be knocked out by the day. The sun was bright, and Franny could read the thermometer outside the back kitchen window. The mercury stood just under 80. It was a beautiful day, and her father was dead. Was there any connection other than the obvious tear-jerky one? She frowned over it, her eyes confused and apathetic. Her mind circled the problem, then drifted away to think of other things, but it always drifted back. It was a beautiful, warm day, and her father was dead. That brought it home to her all at once, and her eyes squeezed shut as if from a blow. At the same time, her hands jerked involuntarily on the tablecloth, yanking her plate off onto the floor. It shattered like a bomb, and Franny screamed, her hands going to her cheeks, digging furrows there. The wandering, apathetic vagueness disappeared from her eyes, which were suddenly sharp and direct. It was as if she had been slapped hard, or had an open bottle of ammonia waved under her nose. You can't keep a corpse in the house, not in high summer. The apathy began to creep back in, blurring the outlines of the thought. The full horror of it began to be obscured, cushioned. She began to listen for the clunk and drop of the ice cubes again. She fought it off. She got up, went to the sink, ran the cold water on full, and then splatted cupped handfuls against her cheeks, shocking her lightly perspiring skin. She could drift away all she wanted, but first this thing had to be solved. It had to be. She couldn't just let him lie in bed up there as June melted into July. It was too much like that Faulkner story that was in all the college anthologies. A rose for Emily. The town fathers hadn't known what that terrible smell was, but after a while it had gone away. No, she cried aloud to the sunny kitchen. She began to pace, thinking about it. Her first thought was the local funeral home, but who would... Stop backing away from it, she shouted furiously into the empty kitchen. Who's going to bury him? At the sound of her own voice, the answer came. It was perfectly clear. She was, of course. Who else? She was. It was 2:30 in the afternoon when she heard the car turn into the driveway, its heavy motor purring complacently, low with power. Franny put the spade down on the edge of the hole. She was digging in the garden between the tomatoes and the lettuce, and turned around, a little afraid. The car was a brand-new Cadillac Coupe de Ville, bottle green, and stepping out of it was fat 16-year-old Harold Lauder. Franny felt an instant surge of distaste. She didn't like Harold and didn't know anyone who did, including his late sister Amy. Probably his mother had. But it struck Fran with a tired sort of irony that the only person left in a gunkwit besides herself should be one of the very few people in town she honestly didn't like. Harold edited the Agunquit High School literary magazine and wrote strange short stories that were told in the present tense or with the point of view in the second person, or both. You come down the delirious corridor and shoulder your way through the splintered door and look at the racetrack stars. That was Harold's style. He whacks off in his pants, Amy had once confided to Fran. How's that for nasty? Whacks off in his pants and wears the same pair of undershorts until they'll just about stand up by themselves. Harold's hair was black and greasy. He was fairly tall, about 6'1", but he was carrying nearly 240 pounds. He favored cowboy boots with pointed toes, wide leather garrison belts that he was constantly hitching up because his belly was considerably larger than his butt, and flowered shirts that billowed on him like staysails. Franny didn't care how much he whacked off, how much weight he carried, or if he was imitating Wright Morris this week or Hubert Selby Jr., but looking at him she always felt uncomfortable and a little disgusted, as if she sensed by low-grade telepathy that almost every thought Harold had was coated lightly with slime. She didn't think, even in a situation like this, that Harold could be dangerous, but he would probably be as unpleasant as always, perhaps more so. He hadn't seen her. He was looking up at the house. "Anybody home?" he shouted, then reached through the Cadillac's window and honked the horn. The sound jagged on Franny's nerves. She would have kept silent, except that when Harold turned around to get back into the car, he would see the excavation and her sitting on the end of it. For a moment she was tempted to crawl deeper into the garden and just lie low among the peas and beans until he got tired and went away. "Stop it," she told herself. "Just stop it. He's another living human being, anyway. "Over here, Harold," she called. Harold jumped, his large buttocks joggling inside his tight pants. Obviously, he had just been going through the motions, not really expecting to find anyone. He turned around, and Fran walked to the edge of the garden, brushing at her legs, resigned to being stared at in her white gym shorts and halter. Harold's eyes crawled over her with great avidity as he came to meet her. "Say, Fran," he said happily. "Hi, Harold. I'd heard that you were having some success in resisting the dread disease, so I made this my first stop. I'm canvassing the township." He smiled at her, revealing teeth that had at best a nodding acquaintance with his toothbrush. "I was awfully sorry to hear about Amy, Harold. Are your mother and father—" "I'm afraid so," Harold said. He bowed his head for a moment, then jerked it up, making his clotted hair fly. "But life goes on, does it not?" "I guess it does," Fran said wanly. His eyes were on her breasts again, dancing across them, and she wished for a sweater. "How do you like my car?" "It's Mr. Brannigan's, isn't it?" Roy Brannigan was a local realtor. "It was," Harold said indifferently. "I used to believe that in these days of shortages, anyone who drove such a thyroidal monster ought to be hung from the nearest Sunoco sign, but all of that has changed. Less people means more petrol." "Petrol," Fran thought dazedly. He actually said petrol. "More everything," Harold finished. His eyes took on a fugitive gleam as they dropped to the cup of her navel, rebounded to her face, dropped to her shorts, and bounced to her face again. His smile was both jolly and uneasy. "Harold, if you'll excuse me, but whatever can you be doing, my child?" The unreality was trying to creep back in again, and she found herself wondering just how much the human brain could be expected to stand before snapping like an overtaxed rubber band. "My parents are dead, but I can take it. Some weird disease seems to have spread across the entire country, maybe the entire world, mowing down the righteous and the unrighteous alike. I can take it. I'm digging a hole in the garden my father was weeding only last week, and when it's deep enough, I guess I'm going to put him in it. I think I can take it. But Harold Lauder in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac, feeling me up with his eyes and calling me my child? I don't know, my lord, I just don't know." "Harold," she said patiently, "I am not your child. I am 5 years older than you. It is physically impossible for me to be your child." "Just a figure of speech," he said, blinking a little at her controlled ferocity. "Anyway, what is it?" "That hole." "A grave for my father." "Oh," Harold Lauder said in a small, uneasy voice. "I'm going in to get a drink of water before I finish up. To be blunt, Harold, I'd just as soon you went away. I'm upset." "I can understand that," he said stiffly. "But Fran, in the garden?" She had started toward the house, but now she rounded on him, furious. "Well, what would you suggest? That I put him in a coffin and drag him out to the cemetery? What in the name of God for? He loved his garden. And what's it to you anyway? What business is it of yours?" She was starting to cry. She turned and ran for the kitchen, almost running into the Cadillac's front bumper. She knew Harold would be watching her jiggling buttocks, storing up the footage for whatever X-rated movie played constantly in his head, and that made her angrier, sadder, and more weepy than ever. The screen door whacked flatly shut behind her. She went to the sink and drank 3 cold glasses of water too quickly, and a silver spike of pain sank deeply into her forehead. Her surprised belly cramped, and she hung over the porcelain sink for a moment, eyes slitted closed, waiting to see if she was going to throw up. After a moment, her stomach told her it would take the cold water, at least on a trial basis. "Fran?" The voice was low and hesitant. She turned and saw Harold standing outside the screen, his hands dangling limply at his sides. He looked concerned and unhappy, and Fran suddenly felt badly for him. Harold Lauder tooling around this sad, ruined town in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac. Harold Lauder, who had probably never had a date in his life and so affected what he probably thought of as worldly disdain. For dates, girls, friends, everything. Including himself, most likely. Harold, I'm sorry. No, I didn't have the right to say anything. Look, if you want me to, I can help. Thank you, but I'd rather do it alone. It's personal, of course, I understand. She could have gotten a sweater from the kitchen closet, but of course he would have known why, and she didn't want to embarrass him again. Harold was trying hard to be a good guy, something which must have been a little like speaking a foreign language. She went back out on the porch, and for a moment they stood there looking at the garden, at the hole with the dirt thrown up around it. And the afternoon buzzed solemnly around them as if nothing had changed.
"What are you going to do?" she asked Harold.
"I don't know," he said. "You know—" he trailed off.
"What?"
"Well, it's hard for me to say. I'm not one of the most loved persons in this little patch of New England. I doubt if a statue would ever have been erected in my memory on the local common, even if I had become a famous writer, as I had once hoped. Parenthetically speaking, I believe I may be an old man with a beard down to my belt buckle before there is another famous writer." She said nothing, only went on looking at him. "So," Harold exclaimed, and his body jerked as if the word had exploded out. "So I am forced to wonder at the unfairness of it. The unfairness seems, to me at least, so monstrous that it is easier to believe that the louts who attend our local citadel of learning have finally succeeded in driving me mad." He pushed his glasses up on his nose, and she noticed with sympathy how really horrible his acne problem was. Had anyone ever told him, she wondered, that soap and water would take care of some of that? Or had they all been too busy watching Pretty Petite Amy as she zoomed through the University of Maine with a 3.8 average, graduating 23rd in a class of over 1,000? Pretty Amy, who was so bright and vivacious where Harold was just abrasive. "Mad," Harold repeated softly. "I've been driving around town in a Cadillac on my learner's permit. And look at these boots." He pulled up the legs of his jeans a little, disclosing a gleaming pair of cowboy boots, complexly stitched.
$86. I just went into the shoeboat and picked out my size. I feel like an imposter, an actor in a play. There have been moments today when I've been sure I was mad."
"No," Franny said. He smelled like he hadn't had a bath in 3 or 4 days, but this no longer disgusted her.
"What's that line? I'll be in your dream if you'll be in mine. We're not crazy, Harold."
"Maybe it would be better if we were."
"Someone will come," Franny said, "after a while, after this disease, whatever it is, burns itself out."
"Who?"
"Somebody in authority," she said uncertainly. "Somebody who will, well, put things back in order."
He laughed bitterly.
"My dear child, sorry, Fran. Fran, it was the people in authority who did this. They're good at putting things back in order. They've solved the depressed economy, pollution, the oil shortage, and the Cold War, all at a stroke. Yeah, they put things in order, all right. They solved everything the same way Alexander solved the Gordian knot, by cutting it in two with his sword."
"But it's just a funny strain of the flu, Harold. I heard it on the radio.
Mother Nature just doesn't work that way, Fran. You're somebody in authority got a bunch of bacteriologists, virologists, and epidemiologists together in some government installation to see how many funny bugs they could dream up. Bacteria, viruses, germplasm, for all I know. And one day some well-paid toady said, 'Look what I made. It kills almost everybody, isn't it great?' And they gave him a medal and a pay raise and a time-sharing condo, and then somebody spilled it."
"What are you going to do, Fran?"
"Bury my father," she said softly.
"Oh, of course."
He looked at her for a moment and then said very swiftly, "Look, I'm going to get out of here, out of Ogunquit. If I stay much longer, I really will go crazy. Fran, why don't you come with me?"
"Where?"
"I don't know, not yet."
"Well, if you think of a place, come ask me again."
Harold brightened.
"All right, I will. You see, it's a matter of—"
He trailed off and began to walk down the porch steps in a kind of daze. His new cowboy boots gleamed in the sun. Fran watched him with sad amusement. He waved just before climbing behind the wheel of the caddy. Fran lifted a hand in return.
The car jerked unprofessionally when he put it in reverse, and then he was backing down the driveway in fits and starts. He wandered to the left, crushing some of Carla's flowers under the offside wheels, and nearly thumped into the culvert ditch as he turned out onto the road. Then he honked twice and was gone. Fran watched until he was out of sight, and then went back to her father's garden. Sometime after 4 o'clock, she went back upstairs with dragging footsteps, forcing herself along. There was a dull headache in her temples and forehead, caused by heat and exertion and tension. She had told herself to wait another day, but that would only make it worse. Under her arm, she carried her mother's best damask tablecloth, the one kept strictly for company. It did not go as well as she had hoped, but it was also nowhere near as bad as she had feared. There were flies on his face, lighting, rubbing their hairy little forelegs together, and then taking off again, and his skin had gone a dusky dark shade, but he was so tanned from working in the garden that it was hardly noticeable, if you made your mind up not to notice it, that was. There was no smell, and that was what she had been most afraid of. The bed he had died in was the double he had shared for years with Carla. She laid the tablecloth out on her mother's half, so that its hem touched her father's arm, hip, and leg. Then, swallowing hard, her head was pounding worse than ever, she prepared to roll her father onto his shroud. Peter Goldsmith was wearing his striped pajamas, and that struck her as jarringly frivolous, but they would have to do. She could not even entertain the thought of first undressing and then dressing him again. Steeling herself, she grasped his left arm, it was as hard and unyielding as a piece of furniture, and pushed, rolling him over. As she did so, a hideous long burping sound escaped him, a belch that seemed to go on and on, rasping in his throat as if a locust had crawled down there and had now come to life in the dark channel, calling and calling. She screeched, stumbling away and knocking over the bed table. His combs, his brushes, the alarm clock, a little pile of change and some tie clips and cufflinks all jingled and fell to the floor. Now there was a smell, a corrupted gassy smell, and the last of the protective fog which had wrapped her dissipated, and she knew the truth. She fell to her knees and wrapped her arms around her head and wailed. She was not burying some life-sized doll. It was her father she was burying, and the last of his humanity, the very last, was the juicy, gassy smell that now hung on the air. And it would be gone soon enough. The world went gray, and the sound of her own grief, braying and constant, began to seem distant, as if someone else was uttering those sounds, perhaps one of the little brown women you see on the TV news clips. Some length of time went by, she had no idea how long, and then, little by little, she came back to herself and to the knowledge of all that still remained to be done. They were the things she could not have brought herself to do before. She went to him and turned him over. He uttered another belch, this one small and dwindling. She kissed his forehead. "I love you, Daddy," she said. "I love you. Franny loves you." Her tears fell on his face and gleamed there. She removed his pajamas and dressed him in his best suit, hardly noticing the dull throb in her back, the ache in her neck and arms as she lifted each part of his weight, dressed it, dropped it, and went on to the next part. She propped his head up with 2 volumes of the Book of Knowledge to get his tie right. In his bottom drawer, under the socks, she found his army medals, Purple Heart, Good Conduct medals, campaign ribbons, and the bronze star he had won in Korea. She pinned them to his lapel. In the bathroom, she found Johnson's baby powder and powdered his face and neck and hands. The smell of the powder, sweet and nostalgic, brought the tears on again. Sweat slicked her body. There were pitted dark circles of exhaustion under her eyes. She folded the tablecloth over him, got her mother's sewing kit, and closed the seam. Then she doubled the seam and sewed again. With a sobbing, whistling grunt, she managed to get his body to the floor without dropping it. Then she rested, half swooning. When she felt she could go on, she lifted the top half of the corpse, got it to the head of the stairs, and then, as carefully as she could, down to the first floor. She stopped again, her breath coming in quick, whining gasps. Her headache was sharp now, needling into her with quick, hard bursts of pain. She dragged the body down the hall, through the kitchen, and out onto the porch. Down the porch steps. Then she had to rest again. The golden light of early evening was on the land now. She gave way again and sat beside him, her head on her knees, rocking back and forth, weeping. Birds twittered. Eventually she was able to drag him into the garden. At last it was done. By the time the last sods were back in place, she had fitted them together down on her knees as if doing a jigsaw puzzle. It was 9:15. She was filthy. Only the flesh around her eyes was white. That area had been washed clean by her tears. She was reeling with exhaustion. Her hair hung against her cheeks in matted strings. "Please be at peace, Daddy," she muttered. "Please." She dragged the spade back to her father's workshop and slung it inside indifferently. She had to rest twice as she climbed the 6 steps to the back porch. She crossed the kitchen without turning on the lights and kicked off her low-topped sneakers as she entered the living room. She dropped to the couch and slept immediately. In the dream, she was climbing the stairs again, going to her father to do her duty and see him decently under the ground. But when she entered the room, the tablecloth was already over the body, and her sense of grief and loss changed to something else, something like fear. She crossed the darkened room, not wanting to, suddenly wanting only to flee, but helpless to stop. The tablecloth glimmered in the shadows, ghostly, ghastly, and it came to her. It wasn't her father under there. And what was under there was not dead. Something, someone, filled with dark life and hideous good cheer was under there. And it would be more than her life was worth to pull that tablecloth back, but she couldn't stop her feet. Her hand reached out, floated over the tablecloth, and snatched it back. He was grinning, but she couldn't see his face. A wave of frigid cold blasted up at her from that awful grin. No, she couldn't see his face, but she could see the gift this terrible apparition had brought for her unborn baby. A twisted coat hanger. She fled, fled from the room, from the dream, coming up, surfacing briefly. Surfacing briefly in the 3 o'clock darkness of the living room, her body floating on a foam of dread, the dream already tattering and unraveling, leaving behind it only a sense of doom like the rancid aftertaste of some rotten meal. She thought, in that moment of half-sleeping and half-waking, "Him. It's him, the walkin' dude. The man with no face." Then she slept again, this time dreamlessly, and when she woke the next morning she didn't remember the dream at all. But when she thought of the baby in her belly, a feeling of fierce protectiveness swept over her all at once, a feeling that perplexed her and frightened her a little with its depth and strength. Chapter 29. That same evening, as Larry Underwood slept with Rita Blakemore, and as Franny Goldsmith slept alone, dreaming her peculiarly ominous dream, Stuart Redman was waiting for Elder. He had been waiting for 3 days, and this evening Elder did not disappoint him. At just past noon on the 24th, Elder and 2 male nurses had come and taken away the television. The nurses had removed it while Elder stood by, holding his revolver, neatly wrapped in a baggie, on Stu. But by then, Stu hadn't wanted or needed the TV. It was just putting out a lot of confused shit anyway. All he had to do was stand at his barred window and look out at the town on the river below. Like the man on the record said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Smoke was no longer billowing from the stacks of the textile mill. The gaudy stripes and eddies of dye in the river had dissipated, and the water ran clear and clean again. Most of the cars, glittering and toy-like from this distance, had left the mill's parking lot and hadn't come back. By yesterday, the 26th, there had been only a few cars still moving on the turnpike, and those few had to weave between the stalls like skiers in a slalom race. No wreckers had come to remove the abandoned vehicles. The downtown area was spread out below him like a relief map, and it seemed totally deserted. The town clock, which had chimed off the hours of his imprisonment here, had not tolled since 9 this morning, when the little tune that preceded the striking had sounded draggy and weird, like a tune played underwater by a drowned music box. There had been a fire at what looked like a roadside cafe or maybe a general store just outside of town. It had burned merry hell all this afternoon, black smoke etched against the blue sky, but no fire engines had come to put it out. If the building hadn't been set in the middle of an asphalt parking lot, Stu supposed that half the town might have gone up. Tonight the ruins were still smoldering in spite of an afternoon spat of rain. Stu supposed that Elder's final orders were to kill him. Why not? He would only be one more corpse, and he knew their little secret. They had been unable to find a cure or to discover how his bodily makeup varied from all those who had succumbed. The thought that there would be precious few left he could tell their secret to had probably never even entered their computations. He was a loose thread held hostage by a bunch of tight assholes. Stu was sure that a hero in a television program or a novel could have thought of a way to escape. Hell, even some people in real life. But he wasn't one of them. In the end, he had decided with a certain panicky resignation that the only thing to do would be to wait for Elder and just try to be ready. Elder was the clearest sign that this installation had been breached by what the help sometimes called blue, and sometimes the superflu. The nurses called him Dr. Elder, but he was no doctor. He was in his mid-50s, hard-eyed and humorless. None of the doctors before Elder had felt a need to hold a gun on him. Elder scared Stu because there would be no reasoning or pleading with such a man. Elder was waiting for orders. When they came, he would carry them out. He was a spear carrier, the army version of a mafia button man, and it would never occur to him to question his orders in the light of ongoing events. 3 years ago, Stu had gotten a book called Watership Down to send to a nephew of his in Waco. He had gotten out a box to put the book in, and then, because he hated to wrap presents even more than he hated to read, he had thumbed to the first page, thinking he would scan a little of it to see what it was about. He read that first page, then the second, and then he was enthralled. He had stayed up all night, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and plowing steadily along, the way a man does when he's not much used to reading just for the pleasure of it. The thing turned out to be about rabbits, for Christ's sake, the stupidest, most cowardly animals of God's earth. Except the guy who wrote that book made them seem different. You really cared about them. It was a pretty damn good story, and Stu, who read at a snail's pace, finished it 2 days later. The thing he remembered most from that book was a phrase, going tharn, or just tharn. He understood it at once because he had seen plenty of tharn animals and run down a few on the highway. An animal which had gone tharn would crouch in the middle of the road, its ears flattened, watching as a car rushed toward it, unable to move from the certain oncoming death. A deer could be driven tharn simply by shining a flashlight in its eyes. Loud music would do it to a raccoon, and constant tapping on its cage would do it to a parrot. Elder made Stu feel like that. He would look into Elder's flat blue eyes and feel all the will drain out of him. Elder probably wouldn't even need the pistol to dispose of him. Elder probably had had courses in karate, savate, and general dirty tricks. What could he possibly do against a man like that? Just thinking about Elder made his will to even try want to drain away. Tharn. It was a good word for a bad state of mind. The red light went on over the door at just past 10 p.m., and Stu felt light perspiration break on his arms and face. It was this way every time the red light went on, because one of these times Elder would be alone. He would be alone because he wouldn't want witnesses. There would be a furnace somewhere to cremate plague victims. Elder would bundle him into it. Snip. No more loose ends. Elder stepped through the door. Alone. Stu was sitting on his hospital bed, one hand resting on the back of his chair. At the sight of Elder, he felt a familiar sickening drop in his belly. He felt the familiar urge to spill out a flood of loose, pleading words, in spite of his knowledge that such pleas would avail him nothing. There was no mercy in the face behind the white suit's transparent visor. Now everything seemed very clear to him, very colorful, very slow. He could almost hear his eyes rolling in their bed of lubrication as he followed Elder's progress into the room. He was a big man, stocky, and his white suit was stretched too tight over him. The hole at the end of the pistol he held looked tunnel size.
"How are you feeling?" Elder asked, and even through the tinny speaker Stu could hear the nasal quality of Elder's voice.
Elder was sick.
"Just the same," Stu said, surprised at the evenness of his voice.
"Say, when do I get out of here?"
"Very soon now," Elder said. He was pointing the gun in Stu's general direction, not precisely at him, but not precisely away either. He uttered a muffled sneeze.
"You don't talk much, do you?"
Stu shrugged.
"I like that in a man," Elder said. "You're big talkers, they're your whimperers and whiners and bellyachers. I just got the word on you about 20 minutes ago, Mr. Redmond. They're not such hot orders, but I think you'll do okay."
"What orders?"
"Well, I've been ordered to—"
Stu's eyes flicked past Elder's shoulder toward the high, riveted sill of the airlock door.
"Christ Jesus!" he exclaimed. "That's a fucking rat. What kind of place are you running with rats in it?"
Elder turned, and for a moment Stu was almost too surprised by the unexpected success of his ruse to go on. Then he slid off the bed and grasped the back of his chair in both hands as Elder began to pivot toward him again. Elder's eyes were wide and suddenly alarmed. Stu lifted the chair over his head and stepped forward, swinging it down, getting every ounce of his 180 behind it.
"Get back there!" Elder cried. "Don't!"
The chair crashed down on his right arm. The gun went off, disintegrating the baggie, and the bullet screamed off the floor. Then the gun fell to the carpet, where it discharged again. Stu was afraid he could count on only one more blow with the chair before Elder fully recovered himself. He determined to make it a good one. He brought it around in a high, hard arc, a Henry Aaron home run swing. Elder tried to get his broken right arm up and couldn't. The legs of the chair crashed into the hood of the white suit. The plastic faceplate splintered in Elder's eyes and nose. He screamed and fell backward. He rolled onto all fours and scrambled for the gun lying on the carpet. Stu swung the chair one last time, bringing it down on the back of Elder's head. Elder collapsed. Panting, Stu reached down and grabbed the gun. He stepped away, pointing it at the prone body, but Elder didn't move. For a moment, a nightmarish thought tormented him. What if Elder's orders had not been to kill him, but to release him? But that made no sense, did it? If his orders had been to release him, why the talk about no whimpering and whining? Why would he have termed the orders "not so hot"? No, Elder had been sent here to kill him. Stu looked at the prone body, trembling all over. If Elder got up now, Stu thought he would probably miss him with all 5 bullets at point-blank range. But he didn't think Elder was going to get up. Not now. Not ever. Suddenly, the need to get out of there was so strong that he almost bolted blindly through the airlock door and into whatever lay beyond. He had been locked up for over a week, and all he wanted now was to breathe fresh air and then get far, far away from this terrible place. But it had to be done carefully. Stu walked to the airlock, stepped in, and pushed a button marked "Cycle." An air pump went on, ran briefly, and the outer door opened. Beyond it was a small room furnished only with a desk. On it was a thin stack of medical charts and his clothes, the ones he had been wearing on the airplane from Braintree to Atlanta. The cold finger of dread touched him again. Those things would have gone into the crematorium with him, no doubt. His charts, his clothes. So long, Stuart Redman. Stuart Redman would have become an unperson. In fact, there was a slight noise behind him, and Stu turned around fast. Elder was staggering toward him, crouched over, his hands swinging loosely. A jagged splinter of plastic was lodged in one oozing eye. Elder was smiling.
"Don't move," Stu said.
He pointed the gun, steadying it with both hands, and still the barrel jittered. Elder gave no sign that he had heard. He kept coming. Wincing, Stu pulled the trigger. The pistol bucked in his hands, and Elder stopped. The smile had turned into a grimace, as if he had been struck with a sudden gas pain. There was now a small hole in the breast of his white suit. For a moment he stood, swaying,
and then he crashed forward. For a moment, Stu could only stare at him, frozen, and then he blundered into the room where his personal effects were piled on the desk. He tried the door at the far end of the office, and it opened. Beyond the door was a hallway lit by muted fluorescence. Halfway down to the elevator bank, an abandoned gurney cart stood by what was probably the nurse's station. He could hear faint groaning. Someone was coughing, a harsh ratcheting sound that seemed to have no end. He went back into the room, gathered his clothes up, and put them under one arm. Then he went out, closed the door behind him, and started down the hall. His hand was sweating against the grip of Elder's gun. When he reached the gurney, he looked behind him, unnerved by the silence and the emptiness. The coffer had stopped. Stu kept expecting to see Elder creeping or crawling after him, intent on carrying out his final directive. He found himself longing for the closed and known dimensions of his room. The groaning began again, louder this time. At the elevators, another corridor ran at right angles to this one, and leaning against the wall was a man Stu recognized as one of his nurses. His face was swelled and blackened, his chest rising and falling in quick spurts. As Stu looked at him, he began to groan again. Behind him, curled in a fetal position, was a dead man. Farther down the hall there were another three bodies, one of them female. The male nurse, Vic, Stu remembered, his name is Vic, began to cough again.
"Jesus," Vic said. "Jesus, what are you doing out? You're not supposed to be out."
"The Elder came to take care of me, and I took care of him instead," Stu said. "I was lucky he was sick."
"Sweet, bleeding Jesus, you better believe you was lucky," Vic said, and another coughing fit, this one weaker, tore loose from his chest. "That hurts, man. You wouldn't believe how that hurts. What a fuck-up this turned out to be, bleeding Christ."
"Listen, can I do anything for you?" Stu asked awkwardly.
"If you're serious, you can put that gun in my ear and pull the trigger. I'm ripping myself to pieces inside."
He began to cough again and then to groan helplessly. But Stu couldn't do that, and as Vic's hollow groans continued, Stu's nerve broke. He ran for the elevators, away from the blackish face like the moon in partial eclipse, half expecting Vic to call after him in that strident and helplessly righteous voice that the sick always seem to use when they need something from the well. But Vic only went on groaning, and that was somehow worse. The elevator door had shut and the car was already moving downward when it occurred to Stu that it might be booby-trapped. That would be just their speed. Poison gas, maybe, or a cutout circuit that would disengage the cables and send the elevator careering down the shaft to crash at the bottom. He stepped into the middle of the car and looked around nervously for hidden vents or loopholes. Claustrophobia caressed him with a rubber hand, and suddenly the elevator seemed no more than telephone booth size, then coffin size. Premature burial, anyone? He reached out a finger to push the stop button, and then wondered what good that would do if he was between floors. Before he could answer the question, the elevator slid to a smooth, normal stop.
What if there are men with guns out there?
But the only sentinel when the door slid back was a dead woman in a nurse's uniform. She was curled up in a fetal position by a door marked Ladies. Stu stared at her so long that the door began to slide shut again. He put his arm out, and the door bounced obediently back. He stepped out. The hallway led down to a T-junction, and he walked toward it, giving the dead nurse a wide berth. There was a noise behind him, and he whirled, bringing the gun up, but it was only the elevator door sliding shut for the second time. He looked at it for a moment, swallowed hard, then walked on. The rubber hand was back, playing tunes on the base of his spine, telling him to hell with this walk-don't-run bit, let's get out quick before someone, something, can get us. The echoes of his footfalls in this semi-dark corridor of the administration wing was too much like macabre company. Coming to play, Stuart? Very good. Doors with frosted glass panels marched past him, each with its own tale to tell. Dr. Sloan, records and transcripts, Mr. Ballinger, microfilm, copy file, Mrs. Wiggs. Perhaps of the cabbage patch, Stu thought. There was a drinking fountain at the T-junction, but the warm, chlorinated taste of the water made his stomach turn. There was no exit to his left. A sign on the tile wall with an orange arrow beneath read, Library Wing. The corridor seemed to stretch away for miles that way. Some 50 yards down was the body of a man in a white suit, like some strange animal cast up on a sterile beach. His control was getting bad. This place was much, much bigger than he had first assumed. Not that he'd had a right to assume much of anything from what he'd seen when he was admitted, which had been 2 halls, 1 elevator, and 1 room. Now he guessed it to be the size of a largish metropolitan hospital. He could stumble around in here for hours, his footfalls echoing and rebounding, coming across a corpse every now and then. They were strewn about like prizes in some ghastly treasure hunt. He remembered taking Norma, his wife, to a big hospital in Houston when they diagnosed the cancer. Every place you went in there, they had little maps on the walls with little arrows pointing at a dot. The words written on each arrow said, "You are here." They put those up so people wouldn't get lost, like he was now. Lost. Oh, baby, this was bad. This was so bad. "Don't go Tharn now. You're almost home free," he said. And his words echoed back, flat and strange. He hadn't meant to speak aloud, and that made it worse. He turned to the right, setting his back to the library wing, walked past more offices, came to another corridor, and turned down that. He began to look behind himself frequently, assuring himself that no one, Elder maybe, was following him, but unable to believe it. The hallway ended in a closed door that said, "Radiology." A hand-lettered sign hung on the knob. "Closed until further notice. Randall." Stu went back and peered around the corner and back where he had come from. The dead body in the white suit was tiny with distance now, hardly more than a speck, but seeing it there so changeless and eternal made him want to run away as fast as he could. He turned right, setting his back to it again. 20 yards farther up, the corridor branched into another T-junction. Stu turned right and went past more offices. The corridor ended at the microbiology lab. In one of the lab carrels, a young man clad in jockey shorts lay sprawled over his desk. He was comatose, bleeding from the nose and mouth. His breath rattled in and out with a sound like October wind in dead corn husks. And then Stu did begin to run, turning from one corridor to another, becoming more and more convinced that there was no way out, at least not from this level. The echo of his footfalls chased him, as if either Elder or Vic had lived just long enough to put a squad of ghostly MPs on his trail. Then another fancy crowded that out, one he somehow associated with the queer dreams he had been having the last few nights. The idea grew so strong that he became afraid to turn around, afraid that if he did, he would see a white-suited figure striding after him, a white-suited figure with no face, but only blackness behind a plexiglass plate. Some dreadful apparition, a hitman from beyond sane time and space. Panting, Stu rounded a corner, sprinted 10 feet before he realized the corridor was a dead end, and crashed into a door with a sign over it. The sign read, "Exit." He pushed at the bar, convinced it would not move, but it did, and the door opened easily. He went down 4 steps to another door. To the left of this landing, more stairs went down into thick darkness. The top half of this second door was clear glass reinforced with crisscrossed safety wire. Beyond it was only the night, the beautiful, mellow summer night, and all the freedom a man ever dreamed of. Stu was still staring out, transfixed, when the hand slipped out of the darkness of the stairwell and grasped his ankle. A gasp tore at Stu's throat like a thorn. He looked around, his belly a freezing flow of ice, and beheld a bloody, grinning face upturned in the darkness.
"Come down and eat chicken with me, beautiful," it whispered in a cracked and dying voice. "It's so dark."
Stu screamed and tried to pull free. The grinning thing from the darkness held on, talking and grinning and chuckling. Blood or bile was trickling from the corners of its mouth. Stu kicked at the hand holding his ankle, then stomped it. The face hanging in the darkness of the stairwell disappeared. There was a series of thudding crashes, and then the screams began. Of pain or of rage, Stu couldn't tell. He didn't care. He battered against the outside door with his shoulder. It banged open and he tottered out, whirling his arms to keep his balance. He lost it anyway and fell down on the cement path. He sat up slowly, almost warily. Behind him, the screams had stopped. A cool evening breeze touched his face, dried the sweat on his brow. He saw with something very like wonder that there was grass and flower beds. Night had never smelled as fragrantly sweet as this. A crescent moon rode the sky. Stu turned his face up to it thankfully, and then walked across the lawn toward the road which led to the town of Stovington below. The grass was dressed with dewfall. He could hear wind whispering in the pines.
"I'm alive," Stu Redmond said to the night.
He began to cry.
"I'm alive. Thank God I'm alive. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you."
Tottering a little, he began to walk down the road. Chapter 30. Dust blew straight across the Texas scrubland, and at twilight it created a translucent curtain that made the town of Arnett seem like a sepia ghost image. Bill Hapscom's Texaco sign had blown down and lay in the middle of the road. Someone had left the gas on in Norm Bruett's house, and the day before, a spark from the air conditioner had blown the whole place sky high, rattling lumber and shingles and Fisher-Price toys all over Laurel Street. On Main Street, dogs and soldiers lay dead together in the gutter. In Randy's superette, a man in PJs lay draped over the meat counter, his arms hanging down. One of the dogs now lying in the gutter had been at this man's face before losing its appetite. Cats did not catch the flu, and dozens of them wove in and out of the twilight stillness like smoky shades. From several houses, the sound of television snow ran on and on. A random shutter banged back and forth. A red wagon, old and faded and rusty, the words Speedway Express barely legible on its sides, stood in the middle of Durgin Street in front of the Indian Head Tavern. There were a number of returnable beer and soda bottles in the wagon. On Logan Lane, in Arnett's best neighborhood, wind chimes played on the porch of Tony Leominster's house. Tony's scout stood in the driveway, its windows open. A family of squirrels had nested in the back seat. The sun deserted Arnett. The town grew dark under the wing of the night. The town was, except for the chirr and whisper of small animals and the tinkle of Tony Leominster's wind chimes, silent, and silent, and silent. Chapter 31. Christopher Bradenton struggled out of delirium like a man struggling out of quicksand. He ached all over. His face felt alien, as if someone had injected it with silicone in a dozen places, and it was now the size of a blimp. His throat was raw pain, and more frightening, the opening there seemed to have closed from ordinary throat size to something no larger than the bore of a boy's air pistol. His breath whistled in and out through this horribly tiny connection he needed to maintain contact with the world. Still, it wasn't enough. And worse than the steady throbbing soreness, there was a feeling like drowning. Worst of all, he was hot. He could not remember ever having been this hot, not even 2 years ago when he had been driving two political prisoners who had jumped bail in Texas west to Los Angeles. Their ancient Pontiac Tempest had died on Route 190 in Death Valley, and he had been hot then, but this was worse. This was an inside hot, as if he had swallowed the sun. He moaned and tried to kick the covers off, but he had no strength. Had he put himself to bed? He didn't think so. Someone or something had been in the house with him. Someone or something. He should remember, but he couldn't. All Bradenton could remember was that he had been afraid even before he got sick, because he knew someone or something was coming, and he would have to... What? He moaned again and rocked his head from side to side on the pillow. Delirium was all he remembered. Hot phantoms with sticky eyes. His mother had come into this plain log bedroom, his mother who had died in 1969, and she had talked to him. "Kit, oh, Kit, I told you, don't get mixed up with those people," I said.
I don't care nothing about politics, I said, but those men you hang around with are crazy as mad dogs, and those girls are nothing but whores. I told you, Kit. And then her face had broken apart, letting through a horde of grave beetles from the splitting yellow parchment fissures, and he had screamed until blackness wavered, and there was confused shouting, the slap of shoe leather as people ran, lights, flashing lights, the smell of gas. And he was back in Chicago, the year was 1968, somewhere voices were chanting, "The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching! The whole world!" And there was a girl lying in the gutter by the entrance to the park, her body clad in overall jeans, her feet bare, her long hair full of glass fragments, her face a glittering mask of blood that was black in the heartless white glow of the streetlights, the mask of a crushed insect. He helped her to her feet, and she screamed and shrank against him, because an outer space monster was advancing out of the drifting gas, a creature clad in shining black boots and a flak jacket and a wall-eyed gas mask, holding a truncheon in one hand, a can of mace in the other, and grinning. And when the outer space monster pushed its mask back, revealing its grinning, flaming face, they had both screamed, because it was the somebody or something he had been waiting for, the man Kit Bradenton had always been terrified of. It had been the walkin' dude. Bradenton's screams had shattered the fabric of that dream like high sea shatters fine crystal, and he was in Boulder, Colorado, an apartment on Canyon Boulevard. Summer and hot, so hot that even in your skivvy shorts your body was trickling sweat, and across from you stands the most beautiful boy in the world, tall and tanned and straight. He is wearing lemon-yellow bikini briefs, which cling lovingly to every ridge and hollow of his precious buttocks. And you know if he turns, his face will be like a Raphael angel, and he will be hung like the Lone Ranger's horse. Hi-yo, Silver, away! Where did you pick him up? A meeting to discuss racism on the CU campus? Or in the cafeteria? Hitchhiking? Does it matter? Oh, it's so hot, but there's water. A pitcher of water, an urn of water carved with strange figures which stand out in bas-relief, and beside it the pill. No, the pill. The one that will send him off to what this angel in the light-yellow briefs calls Huxley Land. The place where the moving finger writes and doesn't move on. The place where flowers grow on dead oak trees. And boy, what an erection is tenting out your skivvies. Has Kit Bradenton ever been so horny, so ready for love? Come to bed, you say to that smooth brown back. Come to bed and do me, and then I'll do you, just the way you like. Take your pill first, he says without turning. Then we'll see. You take the pill, the water is cool in your throat, and little by little the strangeness comes over your sight, the weirdness that makes every angle in the place a little more or a little less than 90 degrees. For some time you find yourself looking at the fan on the cheap Grand Rapids bureau, and then you're looking at your own reflection in the wavy-looking glass above it. Your face looks black and swelled, but you don't let it worry you because it's just the pill, only the pill. Trips, you murmur. Oh, boy, Captain Trips and I am so horny. He begins to run, and at first you have to look at those smooth hips where the elastic of his briefs rides so low, and then your gaze moves up the flat, tanned belly, then to the beautiful hairless chest, and finally from the slimly corded neck to the face. And it is his face, sunken and happy and ferociously grinning, not the face of a Raphael angel, but of a Goya devil, and from each blank eye socket there peers the reptilian face of an adder. He is coming toward you as you scream. He is whispering, "Trips, baby, Captain Trips." Then murkiness. Faces and voices that he didn't remember. And at last he had surfaced here, in the small house he had built with his own hands on the outskirts of Mountain City. Because now is now, and the great wave of revolt which had engulfed the country had long since withdrawn. The young Turks were now mostly old lags with gray in their beards and big coke-burned holes where their septa used to be. And this was the wreckage baby. The boy in the yellow briefs had been long ago, and in Boulder, Kit Bradenton had been little more than a boy himself. My God, am I dying? He beat at the thought with agonized horror, the heat rolling and billowing in his head like a sandstorm. And suddenly his short, quick respiration stopped,
as a sound began to rise from somewhere beyond and below the closed bedroom door. At first, Bradenton thought it was a fire siren or a police car siren. It rose